it's kind of interesting because I think that there still is a lot of residual kind of hang up around hard spirits.
Hey everyone, this week's episode is great. We get to sit down with my friend Jason, who owns Copper Muse Distillery, which is about one block away from where I'm currently sitting, recording this in Fort Collins, Colorado. This is fun because I feel like spirits get a bad rap. We are thinking about craft beer and craft coffee and, you know, wine has sommeliers and stuff, but I feel like a lot of people just think that spirits should just be thrown in cocktails or drink by themselves to get drunk or whatever it might be. But spirits have a bad rap, and Copper Muse really is doing an amazing job of showing that distilling spirits is a craft. And I just don't feel like we see this that often. And also Jason and their team, they're doing so many cool things with infusions and different things. And so I think that you will really like this episode. Jason was a former engineer who cashed in his retirement early to start his dream of owning a distillery. So without further ado, let's go ahead and get started on this week's episode of the Small Business Storytellers. Welcome to the Small Business Storytellers, the podcast designed for business owners, marketers, and entrepreneurs wanting to make an impact through the work that they do. I'm your host, Seth Silvers, and my passion is building brands that last by marketing with stories. On this podcast, we share stories with you of people who are growing their businesses the right way, and we teach you how to grow what you're doing through storytelling and authentic marketing. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Small Business Storytellers. I'm sitting here with Jason Hevelone of Copper Muse Distillery here in Fort Collins, Colorado. And thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear more about your story and also just kind of dive into some of over the last handful of years. How long have you guys been in business?
We've been in business, I guess, almost coming up on 6 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I know, like, in the last 6 years, even just with your location has stayed the same, but everything around you has changed and stuff. So I just feel like I'm curious to just learn some of how you guys have made it through as a business and grown and whatnot. So first to start, just share with us a little bit about just kind of what your business is and where you guys are kind of currently at as a business.
Yeah, sure. So basically we were a craft distillery. So we make spirits. A lot of people ask, well, what kind of beers do you make? You know, not realizing there's a difference between a brewery and a distillery. So we make distilled spirits like, you know, vodka, rum, whiskey, gin, and such. And part of my business is basically, we call it a tasting room, but really it's a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And we have a place where you can get those spirits in these really great craft cocktails that we make. And we really try to focus on giving, you know, our clients cocktails they'll probably never get at a typical bar. You know, you can always get a vodka cranberry somewhere else, but that's not what we're going to focus on there. The other thing is we did add an element of having our own kitchen, which, you know, obviously a lot of breweries in even distilleries, they'll rely more on food trucks or not having, you know, just kind of snack foods and stuff like that. But when my wife and I were kind of thinking of this concept, you know, we kind of thought about, well, when we go out, what do you really like to have, you know, if you're having a cocktail? It's usually a little something to kind of, you know, eat along with that so that you don't get such that full impact of the alcohol. So early on decided that we wanted to do kind of elevate the food a little bit over like kind of pub fare. You know, I love pub fare, but to me that feels more beer like, you know, kind of the burgers and fries and stuff like that. So we really try to focus more on, you know, kind of the tapas, the, you know, the lighter stuff, panini sandwiches and such that, you know, people can share foods and experience, you know, a meat and cheese board or maybe a bacon wrapped scallops or, you know, just real fun kind of stuff there.
Yeah. And I feel like you guys have done it. The food there is great. And I feel like their cocktails really are totally unique, and there's some that some of our family members that like really do not like the taste of alcohol. It's like there's cocktails here that you will love.
Yeah,
because it's like you can tell they're different, but they're creative and stuff. And I really feel like almost anybody could find cocktail in your guys' menu that they like.
Yeah, we really try to explore that with people. And, you know, because it's unlike a brewery where you can get like a little sampler of stuff, and we do offer, you know, tasting flights, but you got to realize with spirits you're talking pretty much shots that you're drinking and stuff. Right. And I'm not a big fan of drinking, you know, just straight alcohol. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, so, you know, really trying to find its home in the right kind of mix of other ingredients in a true cocktail is, right, is really divine. Yeah.
So how did this all get started, and what were you doing before this?
Yeah, so it kind of all goes back to when I was in college at CSU. In the late 80s, went to college to become an electrical engineer. And during that time period, happened to meet my, would then become my wife in the dorms that freshman year. And during that journey, we came across making our own beer, home brewing and stuff, and really fell in love with just making beers that were just so much more tasty than the typical domestic beers that were available at the time. And during that, you know, of course, we were seeing, you know, that's around the time when New Belgium and Odell's were just kind of coming out of their basement operations, and Cooper Smith's here in town, that kind of really built, started that, you know, the initial seeds of the brewing movement we have here in Fort Collins. And of course, you know, we thought we should become brewers ourselves. Mm-hmm. Of course, you know, we were in a school for engineering. I was in for electrical engineering, and my wife was for civil engineering. So two geeks fell in love, kind of a story there. And of course, our parents would have killed us if we didn't pursue that and try to open a brewery right out of college and stuff. Plus, we didn't have any money and stuff, to be honest, too. So we went and started our careers, and she ended up kind of going on to get on her PhD in engineering. And I, you know, worked for a full 15 years in high tech semiconductors in and around the area and stuff. After that, I then went off to a solar startup that also spun out of CSU, where they were able to make really low cost solar panels, not from the typical semiconductor wafers, but from, you know, cheap plate glass that you can kind of sublimate on the solar cell. And went with that startup, and it went really well. And then I could tell it wasn't going to make it and stuff. And during this whole journey of my career, I've always kind of been in the back of my mind thinking I'd want to open a brewery of my own and stuff like that. And as I was at the solar startup, Abound Solar, I could kind of start to see that it wasn't going to make it and stuff. And so you start asking yourself, well, what do you want to do next? You know, do you want to get another job in corporate America? And around that same time, kind of just happened, I had my first craft spirit, and it was from a distillery down in Denver called Leopold Brothers.
Okay.
And they make outstanding spirits, whiskeys and gins. And
yeah, I've seen their stuff.
Yeah, I just had a simple gin and tonic, and I remember I took that first sip, and it reminded me when I had my first craft beer. It was like, whoa, what is this? You know, this is something different. And I kind of explored a little bit and found out what a craft distillery, you know, it hadn't even crossed my mind to open a distillery as opposed to a brewery. And the light bulbs went off, because I kind of felt like the brewery movement obviously was very full, a lot of breweries. I think we're up to 25 now in Fort Collins alone. Yeah. Kind of just felt like that would be kind of a risky business to get into. So, but the craft distilling was just on the, you know, emerging kind of field there. So, I then went to my wife and had that kind of uncomfortable conversation saying, I think I don't want to be an engineer anymore. I want to open my own business. And we went full at it here.
What was that like? Because you're not like a service where you could just go out and say, hey, my name's Jason, will you pay me, you know, $250 and I'll do this for you? Like, it's not like, it's more complicated than starting a business where, you know, you don't really need funding and different things. Like, you need equipment and money to start it. So what was the process of actually going from idea to opening your doors?
Yeah. So what I did was early on, I hooked up with the Small Business Development Center, and of course went through a lot of their classes, as well as their like 12-week course that kind of really helps you build a business plan. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I really kind of believe that that journey of going through a business plan and putting it together, where you kind of fail on paper several times and really ask tough questions of yourself. How are you going to market? How are you going to come up with the funds for all the equipment? You know, what happens if your sales don't come in? Or, you know, how much are you going to, you know, budget for all your many operating expenses and cost of your goods sold? So that was really a big help. The other thing I did was, there are distilleries that will put on various workshops and stuff like that. So we went out to Chicago, and there's a distillery out there called Koval that had like a 3-day workshop. And it was kind of neat, because they didn't just focus on the making of the spirits. They also focused on all the other aspects of your business you're going to have, right? Because you're going to have to deal with, you know, government regulation and insurance, and how are you going to brand your product, and you know, just little stuff like that, and just kind of bringing that all together as all the considerations of really running a business. Because I think so many people, they look, you know, kind of fondly at brewery owners and distillery owners and think, oh, it must just be a lot of fun coming in and hanging out and, you know, sipping a brew. But there, you are running a business, and, you know, you got to have a lot of the nuts and bolts in place and stuff. Mm-hmm. So, you know, those is kind of the things that I use to kind of pull it together. It's not uncommon for a craft distillery to take more than 2 years to go from kind of that initial idea to actually opening your doors for business and stuff. It's a long process with a lot of regulations. Of course, you know, you got to come up with a lot of funds for it, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And even just the licensing process, you know, you basically have to have your lease or your building owned, and you have to purchase all your equipment knowing down to the serial mm-hmm. number before you can apply for even your license and even know if you're going to get it and stuff at the end. So,
wow.
Yeah.
Is there situations where people do all that work and then they don't get it?
There are, I know of at least some local Colorado distillers that, yeah, go down that process and have had to, you know, stretch it out for many years to before they can get there, or they just give up because they just can't get, you know, they've run out of funds, run out of runway to get the business open. So,
what's the, I know with like whiskey distilleries, we, I guess last year we went to Scotland. For a week. And so that was when we really like our palates were like opened up to the world of gin, because they drink gin and tonic everywhere there. And every bar you go into, there's like 15 different gin and tonics on the menu.
Right.
And here it's like, oh, I thought that there was, it's just a gin and tonic. I didn't know there was like this whole world of really craft spirits and different things.
Yeah.
And so we also went to a couple of whiskey distilleries, learned kind of the 4 year rule of whiskey, where it can't be considered whiskey until, you know, 4 years and 1 day. You said, is the main spirits you do rum, vodka, and gin?
Yeah, so actually we have a pretty broad portfolio.
Okay.
And the way that I approach it, as well as several other craft distillers, is because unless you have really deep pockets, it's really hard for you to really base your business just on whiskey because of that aging requirement. So oftentimes what you'll do is you'll start off with spirits that don't really require aging, things like vodka, maybe a silver rum that you can get from, you know, the creation of it to in a bottle. Very quickly, you can start to get that revenue stream coming back again. And while you're doing that, also then starting to put away some of your whiskey, your rum and stuff like that. So we start off just with vodka, and then slowly worked our way into the rums. And all during that whole time, we're starting to put away barrels for the aging process and stuff. Cool. And then, you know, part of that process too, our limitations in our restaurant tasting room is that we can only serve spirits that we make on premise. So I can't bring in any outside alcohol whatsoever. So when we first opened, of course, having vodka, you can make obviously a lot of cocktails out of vodka, but to kind of give it a little more interesting notes, that my staff, my bartending staff, really kind of grasped that idea of kind of creating things.
Yeah.
And they started infusing the vodkas with fresh ingredients, you know, throwing
lavender. Yeah, that's something I've seen in your place that I guess, I don't know if other people do it. I don't think I've noticed it at other places, of like particularly infused spirits.
I think we take it to maybe a more extreme than a lot of others. You know, they may have a few infusions they do, but yeah, we started doing that with just, you know, cucumbers and strawberries, and we even get crazy with throwing bacon into vodka, or you know, beef jerky if you're thinking like a Bloody Mary.
Right.
And before you know it, those became the building blocks for a lot of our craft cocktails, like we talked about earlier. And then, you know, some of those we take to full products that we sell outside of our distillery as well. And that's kind of the other aspect of my business, which is the kind of wholesaling and distribution to, you know, restaurants, bars, and liquor stores outside of us. So
that's awesome. How did you, I mean, it sounds like you had the curiosity at the beginning to like learn about all this, but how do you get to the place where you actually know how to make those spirits and you know how to, you know, test and figure out like this is good and this is bad, and to actually come out with like a pretty technical product? Like I wouldn't say it's like a super simple thing to make, but then how did you get to the place where you actually knew like this is good or this is bad? And we have like a quality product that we can sell to people.
Yeah. Well, this is where I kind of think some of my engineering background helped me out a lot. You know, engineers a lot of times think in terms of design of experiments and things like that. And so it's not uncommon for me. I own a bazillion ball jars. And what we'll end up doing is a lot of experimental splits where we're going to vary these maybe starting ingredients, or maybe these yeasts that we use, or the way that we pull it off the still, the type of, you know, infusions that we do. And then those become variants of our product. And then a lot of it is just through that iterative process. Yeah. The nice thing about having a restaurant tasting room is you've got a lot of natural people that you can try them out with and kind of become our guinea pigs of sorts and say, hey, what do you think about this or that? And of course, we don't hit, you know, 100 or 1,000 every time, 100, 1,000 every time. But it helps us hone in on things for sure.
Was there a moment where maybe it was with, you know, small batches you were doing at home or testing on your own, or in the early days, was there a moment that you realized, like, I think we got something here. Like, I think we can actually make it.
Yeah. You know, it's kind of funny. A lot of people ask if I did a lot of development at home, you know, and stuff. The challenge is that in the United States, it's still illegal to distill at home. It's, you know, you can ferment anything. You make beer, wine, cider. There are obviously a lot of people out there that are distilling at home. And I did a little bit of dabbling there. Mm-hmm. But what I quickly realized is when I was doing that, I was also trying to build my business. And there were so many other things that I needed to get in place. And so, and plus, you know, you can only do so much at such a small scale. You really got to get on your base equipment and start using it and stuff. So I made a pretty active decision early on to learn the mechanics of that and then start to worry about the development of the recipes once I had the equipment in place and kind of start to do that.
So you'd probably distill the whole bunch of batches in your head.
Yeah.
Before you actually did the first one.
There's never a shortage of ideas. Let's just put it that way. If anything, it's like, I got to like purposely say, all right, we got to keep to what we're doing and only introduce just the best of the ideas at this point.
So has the 6 years, has it just been like easy growth year after easy growth year, 6 years in a row, or like... What's the process been? Has it been, I guess, like easier or harder than you expected on the business side of actually growing the business?
Yeah. I guess it's kind of been a mix. In terms of, you know, being able to grow our sales, you know, we first, of course, introduced it a lot to within our restaurant tasting room. And then we, in Colorado, you're allowed to self-distribute your products. And so we started off just, you know, literally grabbing a bag of product and going and knocking on doors at liquor stores and restaurants, getting people to try it. I think Colorado has a really unique kind of set of kind of laws that allows us, that kind of helps with the craft community. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, until recently, all liquor stores were independently owned. You know, they weren't run by all these large corporate entities that you see out there, which allows you as a, you know, a small proprietor, you know, a brewery or a distillery to literally go in there and oftentimes talk to the owner or at least their, you know, second in command there. And they're already kind of keyed into how the success of the craft brewery movement has went and stuff like that. But the challenge about self-distributing is you kind of get to where we basically distributed throughout Northern Colorado and into Denver, and then the reach starts to become hard, right? The resources it takes to get all the way to Grand Junction or Durango or all the way down to Pueblo becomes a lot more difficult. So then you kind of start to get to this tipping point. Should we bring on a distribution partner, which we did, and then that got us access throughout all of Colorado. But, you know, a distributor has a portfolio, a huge portfolio of other products that they're doing. And so their sales reps aren't always, you know, have you first and foremost, you know, in their forethoughts and stuff like that. So you still have to do a lot of hustle yourself to try to get, you know, placements and stuff.
I'm sure having a tasting room is good because you can give the distributors, the sales reps food while you're.
That's right.
While you're trying to impress them.
If you can get them up here. Yeah, for sure. But then, yeah, then we, you know, slowly have added other states. Right now, we distribute in 4 states. We're in New Mexico, we're in Oklahoma, and Michigan, in addition to Colorado. And we're just about to enter into Kansas, actually, here.
It seems like a random spread.
It is. That, you know, I this is where the challenge of the growing the business has come in. You know, with the craft community growing so quickly, it's really hard to even get attention of a distributor and stuff. I felt like I was really just like cold calling and cold emailing a lot of them saying, hey, I'm this great craft distillery in Fort Collins. You want to bring on my spirits? And you just get, you know, silence and you know, crickets out there. So, you know, a lot of it is like my move into New Mexico came actually from one of my interns I hire out of CSU. He was from Albuquerque area, and it turned out his mom's best friend worked at a distributorship and had been visiting and just loved our spirits when they came to our tasting room. So we got moved down there. I had to actually engage an individual that has a business that has a lot of connections in the industry already. And he's kind of helped me get into some other states like Oklahoma and Michigan and do that. So it's just been kind of try to grow that organically. But yeah, the sales piece has been one of the most challenging parts of the business.
What are the other, how many distilleries are there in Northern Colorado? I mean, there's 5,003.
Yeah. So I think even in just in Fort Collins, we have either 7 or 8 craft distilleries.
Okay.
That are here.
And do you know like where Copper Muse ranks? I guess maybe not ranks, but like, I guess size, like give me some understanding of like, how large is Copper Muse compared to other craft distilleries in the state or in the area?
Yeah. So I'd say we're kind of like in the mid pack of it and stuff. The real largest one is Stranahan's down in Denver, which actually they had gotten purchased several years ago by Proximo, which is one of the 7th largest liquor conglomerates in the world. And then there's, of course, Breckenridge Distillery, Montagna Distillery, that are some larger ones. We talked about Leopold Brothers and stuff. Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of like these middle tier ones, which are, you know, now in maybe, let's say, a handful of states and growing and stuff like that. And then, of course, you got the really kind of small, just really kind of almost like kind of like the local brewers that just kind of really don't worry a lot about the wholesale side of the business, focus more on the tasting room and kind of, or emerging new distilleries.
So I want to ask about the whole construction situation with the exchange, because I feel like it's a popular topic amongst businesses now, is like when your city decides to redo your street and all of a sudden nobody wants to come on your street because it's a mess.
Right.
And I feel like, I know like on Campus West in Fort Collins, they're dealing with a lot of that now. And I remember earlier days when like they redid the place near the Alley Cat and stuff, like all those businesses took a hit. So initially, to the listeners, like, describe a little bit about what you guys went through when Fort Collins decided they were going to kind of create this new place called the Exchange, and how did you guys make it through that? Because were you the only business that stuck around?
Yeah, we're the only business that stuck around.
Okay.
And actually, it was initiated from I ended up with a new landlord, Brinkman Partners, a developer here in Northern Colorado. They purchased the property a few years back, and up front they did kind of say, hey, we're buying this whole city block and we're going to want to redevelopment at some point in time, but we don't know exactly when. And then eventually they came back around and said, well, we're ready to kind of launch on this redevelopment. Here's what we want to do. You know, it's going to be great. It's going to bring you all these great customers. But, you know, you, like you alluded to, there's the transition period when you've got chaos and construction all around you. And then there's always the thing that comes with development, which is now an increase in now your rent and all your triple nets and stuff like that. So it basically came down to them, you know, saying, if you want to stick around, you know, your rent's going to more than double. And you're going to have this period of time where, you know, what used to be a nice parking lot outside of our facility became this huge mud pit during the winter period. And we had this narrow entrance into our place that we'd oftentimes have customers say, well, oh, I didn't know you guys were still open, you know, those kind of sentiments. So you were always kind of trying to fight the fact that, you know, we're still here and stuff. But the nice thing is that, you know, part of this process, Brinkman also really wanted us to stay. And so part of that, they did abate part of our rent during that time period so that we wouldn't, you know, they would try to offset a little bit of the business loss we'd have during that period and kind of help transition into the higher rents, you know, once things kind of started off and stuff. But yeah, a lot of it was, luckily, you know, because of social media, you can kind of touch and get out to people and let them know what's going on and kind of help keep your local folks kind of keyed into, you know, that you're still here. And
yeah, what were some things that helped get you guys through that? Because initially it's like, hey, you're going to make less money for a while and then we're going to charge you more.
Yep.
Yeah. So like it's like a double negative,
double-edged sword there. Yeah. It was just a lot of just, you know, trying to be creative on how can we get people in there. And so we started, you know, doing little things like, you know, bringing in like bartending classes where on a Sunday we'll bring in a class of 10 to 12 people and we'll teach them how to be bartenders. We get them behind the bar, teach them how to do a speed pour, like a professional bartender, and people just enjoy that.
Yeah.
We hooked up with a team that brings in comedy one night a week. We brought in bingo, you know, on Tuesday nights to try to, again, kind of just get more excitement, more fun to kind of getting out and about and stuff. So those were the things we kind of did that. And then in the meantime, I also realized that I had to get more revenue. Obviously, you have more expenses. So that's when I really started pushing to try to get out in more states. And that's when we brought on like Oklahoma and Michigan and try to ramp up our production a little bit to kind of offset some of these cost additions. Yeah. So
do you feel like you're in the restaurant industry or in the distilling industry?
It's funny. I really feel like I have three businesses is what I have. I have a manufacturing business, which is all making of the alcohol.
Right.
Excuse me. I have a restaurant, you know, and bar that, of course, has a very, you know, labor intensive, you know, kind of really touching the customer type right. of interface there, which is great because we can create the experiences that we want to, you know, create there. And then I have the wholesale business, which is its own other business there. Mm-hmm. So I always kind of feel like I'm in my own mind, I'm kind of jumping between those three all the time. And right. how do I optimize all of those three? Because they're kind of each have their own challenges and unique needs and stuff.
Right. How has it been hard for you to like split time between all of those? Or like, do you feel like you're kind of constantly running around with different things? Or how's that been for you as kind of the leader of three businesses under one roof?
Yeah. It, you know, of course, as a business owner, you're always wearing way more hats than you want to be wearing right. and stuff. But, you know, like one of the best decisions I ever made early on was, and this came in large part from our discussions with my wife about this business, is she made it very clear she didn't want me there all the time. And, you know, a new business like this mm-hmm. could certainly consume any and all amounts of my time. So I knew I had to hire the right people to run my restaurant side, the tasting room side. And so I hired a very key manager and staff that allowed me to be able to go home in the evenings and on weekends. Mm-hmm. So I'm not there every day and stuff
right.
and hold them accountable for, you know, the growth of that. And of course interact with them very, you know, right. real time and stuff. So that was a huge relief in doing that. On the production side, it's been a little slower, the manufacturing, just because, you know, you got to get to a certain scale to start to justify having full-time people be your help mm-hmm. and stuff. And that's where CSU has been really key in that interns that come out of the fermentation science program. Mm-hmm. It's just really been a neat win-win. I'm now on my sixth intern out of that program. Cool. And it's been great because the students are getting class credit for that. They're getting something that they can add to their resume that is right. definitely very beneficial. And of course, I'm getting talent of these students that are just brilliant. And, you know, a lot of them have dual majors in microbiology and fermentation science. And wow. It's been kind of rewarding to see them, you know, so many of them go into that program thinking they all want to become brewers, you know,
right.
and stuff. And, you know, my first intern, Andrew, that was kind of his initial notion. And then he ended up a job at Bullet Bourbon in Louisville, oh, cool. Kentucky. And
nice.
Then my second intern, he's working at a startup distillery in Utah and stuff.
Okay.
And so, yeah, cool. it's been really neat to kind of see
That's
them all
awesome.
Land.
So you went from being like a career engineer to starting a business. And now you're 6 years in and you haven't closed doors, which is impressive in and of itself. Like, what's helped you to just... And I'm sure there's growth I'm sure it hasn't been perfect, but it's impressive to go from a not being a CEO, not being a business owner, to all of a sudden starting a business in a totally new industry that you haven't worked in before. And initially 6 years later, having a successful business. What's been helpful for you along that journey?
I think in a lot of ways, you really got to shift your paradigm a little bit around, you know, you're really not working to earn an income. I feel like I'm working to build equity is what I am. So I still don't compensate myself very well. I only give myself $5 a day basically for the work that I do, just to kind of run it through the payroll. But I know what I'm doing is I'm investing these dollars and I'm not paying myself to building that business and making it strong. And as things that have kind of hit us, like this rent increase
right.
or all these kind of other kinds of challenges, that's allowed us to be more flexible and have
yeah.
that cash flow to where we don't run out of that runway and then have to make desperate actions mm-hmm. and stuff. And I think it's just really just you have to have that mental grit to just kind of keep pressing on and to get out of that bed and, you know, really to kind of step back occasionally and think, am I doing this to just do it because it feels like activity, or is this really helping, you know, improve my business and make
right.
it profitable and stuff? And I catch myself oftentimes doing the things I like to do or want to do. And it's like, that's not the best part of
right.
what I should be doing for my business.
Yeah.
And you got to always kind of recenter yourself on a real regular basis there.
Yeah. Has there been any elements of like your daily or weekly rhythm or routine that's just helped you to kind of stay focused as a business owner?
Yeah, I think, you know, I have you know, having worked in corporate America for so long, I treat it just as a job. So I make sure I get up, I'm in there by 8 a.m. You know, I'm not leaving there until after 5 p.m. Yeah, but I'm working that Monday through Friday, just keeping that real consistent. Obviously there's flexibility when you have different events and festivals and different things that draw you different places. But it's really kind of getting into where I feel like it's just kind of have that routine, have that, you know, kind of discipline to kind of keep after it and stuff like that. And then of course, all of the, you know, some of the skills I learned when I was working as an engineer, those always kind of help in terms of how you prioritize, how do you decide what, you know, is important versus not.
Yeah.
What do you work on? What do you need? You know, as an engineer, I think one of my weaknesses is I always feel like I can do everything, but that's not the best use of my time. And you know, you got to realize, well, these things I should probably hire out and have other people do, or, you know, bring in a contractor to do that and stuff. And those are, you know, the you got to balance the cost of that versus, you know, your opportunity cost of what other things that you could be working on. Those are always a big challenge to make those decisions.
What would you say is kind of the like motivation for like impact kind of behind the business? Like, what are some ways that you see that Copper Muse can really make an impact, whether it's, you know, I think impact can be so many ways, way more than just, you know, we want to give money away or whatever
it
might be. But like, what does impact look like for you and for the future?
Oh, that's interesting. You know, I mean, real early on, you know, we kind of look to, you know, I always look to like New Belgium and Odell's as like great models and stuff. And so, you know, of course, ideas of sustainability and being good stewards with our natural resources is always first and foremost. So like, you know, early on we invested in like these cooling towers to help us, because in any kind of a brewing or distilling operation, you're always adding or removing heat all the time, and that can be very expensive if you're relying on refrigerated, you know, heat and cooling. And so with the cooling tower, we use that to not only do all our cooling operations in our distillery, but also to cool our space, you know, as our air conditioner in the summer. And likewise, we have these very efficient tankless hot water systems that provide all our brewing water, but they also provide the hot water for our heating coils that heats us in the winter and stuff. So those are always really important. And, you know, what do we do with our waste, making sure that it ends up, you know, in good uses as opposed to just dumping it, you know, and stuff. As far as other impacts, of course, you know, I probably get about 3 to 5 requests for donations for various charities and things like that. And of course, we really try to, you know, help with as much of that as we can. We have a model where we try to really kind of focus on the local and how can we help our local community. It's that idea, as opposed to really trying to get out there, you know, in the broad sense, because I feel like that's where we can have our biggest impacts.
Right. Is there like a, you know, I've heard people say like the big, hairy, audacious goals or whatever. Like, is there some, you know, kind of big dream that you have for where you'd love to see Copper Muse be one day?
Yeah, I guess, again, back to that Odell's in New Belgium, I look at how they grew and it was like wonderful. It wasn't like you saw them go, you know, hockey stick all the way up to 50 states. I think only recently did, you know,
it was maybe only like 2 years ago that New Belgium
finally got to all 50 states. And so it's like, I think that key is like, you know Odell's, I don't even think is in all 50 states, but it's like, you know, let's grow that market, but let's do it organically, let's do it with quality that we don't sacrifice that. And so kind of one of the other missions I have is just like, you know, craft beer really kind of helped with that explosion of tastes and styles and things like that. Same thing, you know, you talked about the different kinds of gins and stuff like that. I think the craft community is really going to help with that too.
Yeah.
And I really want to get, you know, a big part of what, when we make our spirits is I don't want to use anything artificial. You know, it's like, if you're making a cucumber vodka, you should be using cucumbers. You should not be pulling out some vial of cucumber flavor or artificial coloring and things like that. And that produces its own challenges, because now you're dealing with a, you know, a fresh ingredient that can expire, that can have other issues, challenges, you know, much more difficult to filter that material than it is to just add a nice liquid to it. So, but the quality really comes through in there. So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
What do you wish people knew about your industry?
It's kind of interesting,
because I'm sure there's misconceptions.
There is a lot of residual kind of hang up around hard spirits. You know, I think, you know, it's even encoded in our tax system and stuff. Like, if you look at just how much alcohol is in, let's say, a 12-ounce beer versus a glass of wine versus, you know, an equivalent cocktail, they all have the same amount of alcohol. But if you look at the tax burden of that distilled spirit, you're going to be paying 2 to 3 times more taxes on it than you are out of the beer.
Interesting.
And again, a lot of this had to do with, you know, back in Prohibition and when they brought it back, you know, this opinion that, you know, beer was less sinful than wine was more sinful, and then distilled spirits were the devil, you know, and stuff. And, you know, hard spirits don't have to be any more worse or, you know, than a beer or a glass of wine. In fact, that's why, you know, our focus on the cocktail as opposed to just that, you know, kind of, you know, over
taking shots.
Yeah, taking shots. And that's not what we're about at all. You know, it's even, you know, like our restaurant tasting room. We're not a bar. We never wanted to be a bar. We close at the latest at 10 at night. You know, if you want to stay up late and, you know, go out and party more, that's, you know, we have a lot of great places for that here in town. We don't want to be that because, as you know, the quality of your clientele tends to start to go down as that clock gets closer and closer to midnight and later and stuff. And so we really want to, again, focus on that enjoyment, that, you know, treating it more like a food, you know, in that pairing and just the culinary aspects of it there.
Yeah, that's awesome. And I, even in my own family where we didn't have alcohol in our home growing up, and then I was the youngest of five. And so then when I went away to college, then like my parents kind of started drinking some wine and different things. And it's been interesting over the last 10, 15 years to kind of see the, like, just perceptions just change. And even to realize the ones in your own mind that you have, that you're like, well, that's not really right and stuff. And one of those was me and my wife, we joke, because when we were first dating, I'd tell my dad that we were going to meet some friends at a restaurant. And we'd leave and she'd be like, why didn't you just tell him we're going to a bar?
Like, you still were hung up about it. Yeah,
exactly. And it was like, well, like, I think it took a while for my dad to realize that there is social, like, you know, that there's social drinking. Like, you know that people enjoy a drink just to enjoy a drink with friends. But I think that when the perception for so long is people drink to get drunk.
Right.
Changing that takes time and stuff. It and does. I feel like it's really important. Like, I look at alcohol, I mean, it really is a craft. Like, when you see, I mean, when we were in Scotland and we walked into a gin store, the whole store was just different gins, and they let us try anything we wanted. We probably tried, you know, 8 or 9 different gins. Everything tasted totally different. You know, you could taste the flowers coming through and all it was an art form. It wasn't something that you just go in there to take shots to get drunk. Exactly. It was really like appreciating a craft.
Yeah.
It was really interesting. But that perception, I feel like, you know, everybody has their different perceptions about different things and stuff. And I love that that's kind of a focus for you guys.
Yeah, exactly. It's more the quality over the quantity every time. Yeah.
So a lot of the listeners to this show are either currently building or running their own business or kind of aspiring to, what would be kind of some parting words of advice that you would give to young or new entrepreneurs?
Yeah, I think, you know, a big part of it is just to make sure you just keep absorbing ideas all the time, be a continuous learner. You know, I love being part of, like, you know, business book clubs, to, you know, use resources like the Small Business Development Center, the SBA. And then find your counterparts. You know, one of the nice things I've really enjoyed about kind of the craft brewing and the craft distilling community as a whole is that we're very collaborative. And I don't think it's necessarily that, like, all throughout, you know, the world or even the United States, but, you know, in Colorado, you see that community really wants to genuinely help one another. And we know that if we raise all boats, we're going to do better than if we tack each other all the time. And so, you know, I think it's much better for us to think about taking, you know, market share from the large corporate produced spirits as opposed to, you know, trying to worry about one another there. And so make sure you find your counterparts. I'm actually the vice president for the Colorado Distillers Guild, which allows me to get access to the over 100 distilleries throughout the state. Oh, and it's been so neat for us to get together. We're about to have our annual meeting again coming up here in October here and stuff. And, you know, we kind of help with, how do we change, you know, laws to help benefit our industry? How do we help support one another and the challenges of, like, you know, just dealing with, you know, accounts that don't pay for their bills, or where can you find, you know, barrels? I'm desperate. And to, hey, we don't have yeast, and I've got a wort that I need to ferment this weekend. Yeah. Can you help me out there?
Cool.
We do all that. So it's been really neat.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. I think those are wise words. And I've heard some people say, like, don't build the biggest building in town by tearing all the others down. Just build the biggest building.
Exactly. And that's been something really neat to see even here in Fort Collins is, you know, we have a very large distillery and they are wonderful. You know, they've been a great part of our community. And, you know, we all realize that we all have our own business that we're trying to, you know, succeed and stuff like that. And the more that we can kind of work together and help one another, it's just, you know, the best for us. So,
yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks so much for joining us and being willing to just share some of your story. And I hope the best for Copper Muse in the near future. I need to come by and get some cocktails soon.
Thank you, Seth. I appreciate you having me.
Yeah, thanks.
This podcast was produced by Story On Media and Marketing, and our passion is helping small businesses use stories to grow their business, and we create a community that helps you do just that. So if you don't have the budget to hire a big agency, but you really want to learn how to navigate online marketing, how to tell better stories, and really how to build a brand that lasts, then our program, Success with Stories Elite, is for you. Every single week, we give you new trainings, content ideas, and content blueprints to make marketing with stories easy. To join our community, head over to www.successwithstories.com/elite. Or just click on the link in our show notes. Again, that's successwithstories.com/elite. Have an awesome day and let us know what you loved about this episode by leaving a review on iTunes or your favorite podcasting platform. Thank you so much. My name is Seth Silvers and I will see you next time.